Great to have you with us on WPIR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, I've heard it said that when it comes to home repair projects, some people like to get it done for themselves and do it themselves, and others like to get it done right. We're going to take up that topic today. We'll talk about using skilled tradespeople like the licensed electricians and the plumbers. Sometimes even working with those folks can result in some headaches. Sometimes it's hard to find people. Sometimes they're hard to schedule. Sometimes it's hard to afford. So is it all worth it? Well, we have a couple of guests for you today to talk about that. Chad Spate back with us. He is the owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, welcome back.
Larry, great to be here. You know, it occurs to me that the first time I came on your show, I don't think we even had a license for contractors in Wisconsin. That's how long I've been coming on here. So,
well, Tony Trapp hasn't been coming that long, but he's been coming for a while. He's our other guest, Tony Trapp Tony Trapp Remodeling. Tony, good to have you back.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
And as we talk with Chad and Tony, I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe it's about tradespeople. Maybe you just have a general home improvement question, something you're working on that you want to talk about. Join in. Maybe your experiences have been good or bad with tradespeople. We'd love to hear about that as well. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. So, tradespeople, what do we got? We've got, who all would you include in there? I think electricians.
Well, I mean, carpenters.
Plumbers.
You know, plumbers, HVAC.
Drywall, flooring contractors, the roofing and outside contractors. Don't forget our landscaping contractors.
Yep, excavation.
Yep, your concrete folks.
Yep.
So there's lots there. And you guys.
There's a whole army of people to build a house. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's a group effort.
So you guys work with.
I have a lot of friends.
Yeah, as guys in the business, now, you know, you're getting hired to do the work, but some of it, I'm sure you have tradespeople that maybe aren't working for you on a regular basis, right?
That's correct. I mean, so, and there are some rare general contractors that have in-house licensed electricians and plumbers, et cetera, but that's the exception.
They're the guys that or gals that are doing the big projects, probably commercial projects.
Right.
More likely, I would
More
think.
Likely, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, for some contractors, they have trade partners that are doing almost everything. Like the only service they might be providing is managing the project, and then you know they're bringing in framing carpenters that are part of a crew that's subcontracted, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think Tony and I both have businesses where we've got staff carpenters that are doing, you know, roughly half of the labor on a given job. But then the other half is done by licensed trade partners like the ones we were mentioning. So.
And I imagine in your cases, I'm sure you have built some strong relationships.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of these folks we worked with for decades now. And that's part of the advantage of hiring a general contractor, trying to build a team for one project and have it work on the first try is really tricky to do. So our like plumbers and electricians know each other and talk to each other if there's a change and things go more smoothly. So that's part of just having a successful business is having a good group of people to support you and help build that project.
Yeah.
So is there one trade that's more difficult to find if you're
ooh
in shorter supply, let me put it that way.
There's room for highly skilled tile installers. There's room for concrete folks that want to take on smaller projects. There's always people that are willing to do a really good job and stand behind their work. There's going to be a space for you in the industry.
And carpenters, you know, it's a struggle for all of us to find really talented carpenters.
Yeah.
You know, I think of some of the folks that were on our crew back 20, 30 years ago, you know, folks that were in their 50s then.
Yeah.
That
now they're as old as I am.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, their craft is hard to find in an up and coming younger carpenter. And there are some great people out there, but they're just few and far between.
What's the, you know, the trade? What are the trades doing? I know there's some effort to encourage young folks, men and women, to get into the trades.
Yeah, the Madison College has a construction or modeling program, and they're reaching out to diverse, non-traditional folks to get into it. The wages have increased and the benefits have increased over historically. They're lower. But now you can make a living. It's a career. It's not just a job. I would call this, you could have a career in the trades for sure.
So what, irrespective of what you guys pay, I mean, what's a carpenter or a plumber? I mean, what would be an hourly rate that you might think would be maybe a starting rate or?
So I remember when the McKenzie Workforce Development Center opened a few years ago, and that's another resource in the community to train young people. And they had some of that data up on placards. And I want to say that the typical starting wages for incoming tradespeople like electricians or plumbers is in the $35 an hour range. And for a good carpenter, it's like the high 20s. Once you've got 10 years under your belt, you know, you're probably going to be making $40 an hour if you're good at it. So
you're making $1,600 a week at that once you've been in it for a while.
Then it depends, you know, are you providing your own vehicle or is the company providing the vehicle and tools and all the benefits on top of that? Yeah.
Yeah, and all the health benefits and all the rest of that has to go into it. Wow. And we've got a call from Kat in Mesa, Maine. Kat, we'll get to you in just a second. What separates a talented tradesperson from somebody who just works to get the job done? That may be a hard question, or maybe not.
Well,
you know it when you see it, probably.
Well, that's true. That's probably the best answer. But one thing that I would say is really critical is the how much someone cares about the work that they're doing. I mean, that is an intangible that you can't really train. Though you certainly can encourage someone who wants to do well to understand that it's not just the finished product. It's particularly in remodeling, you're in someone's home where they currently live. And so you have to be attentive to where you've set up your tools, what sort of mess you might create and how to mitigate that mess. And then, of course, what the end product looks like and, you know, how you do it so that you're not cutting corners.
You know, I've got a question about how long it takes, but Kat in Mesa, Maine has a question that kind of relates to this, I believe. Let's go there. Kat, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. If I want to do a remodel that involves kitchen and bath updates, I'm wondering what triggers the requirements to bring electrical and whatever else up to code, and what cost should I plan for?
Yeah. Tony, sure. You want to start?
Thank you. I can speak in the Madison area. I believe if you take out more than half the cabinets, then you're required to bring all the electrical up to code. So there's some newer requirements where, like, the refrigerator wants to have its own dedicated circuit and, like, the garbage disposal, and a lot more things are separated than they used to be, even if your kitchen wasn't remodeled that long ago. And in some of the bathrooms, they want to have a dedicated 20-amp circuit for generally, and then a lighting circuit and things of that nature. So depending how much you disturb, and you can always call your local building official up and say, hey, what permits do I need? Plumbing, generally the licensed plumber and electrician should be pulling their permits or going to for those projects. And it's going to be Do you need to get a building permit? Do they all come together or are they separately? Some municipalities, they're all grouped together, and the general contractor or the homeowner will pull the permit and enlist the plumber, electrician, HVAC on there, and other ones they'll get it separately and there'll be separate inspectors. So just having a chat with your building inspector, send them a message. They should be able to give you the information for their locality, and you'd be off and running. And budget-wise, boy, it really depends what you're going to do. I mean, kitchens, you could spend anywhere from a refresh for under $20,000 to above $100,000. And bathrooms, the same thing. It just kind of depends how far you go and what your goals are.
And Cats and Maze and Mania, you guys, we're sitting in Madison, happen to be, and the rules could be different between Maze and Mania and...
Yep.
I mean, there are there's sort of overarching state rules.
Correct, but every municipality has some of its own requirements, and then the way they enforce them is entirely on that municipality.
And it could be updated. I mean, Madison just told me I don't have to get a permit for my shed in my backyard if I follow all their setback rules. That was a new administrative thing a couple of months ago. So
something brand new.
Yeah.
And so it could be changing from 1 year to the next.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Kat, thanks a lot for calling. I hope that helped. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email address talk@wpr.org. Gail emailed. She's had problems hiring contractors. Sometimes they don't show up when scheduled, and is looking for some tips on hiring. If you're a homeowner and you're...
Sure. Well, so one tip would be to do a little research online, I suppose. There are some organizations like the Better Business Bureau, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. There are, of course, various ratings that some, like Google, or there's a company called Guild Quality that a lot of contractors use to solicit verified ratings and customer feedback from actual customers. And Google is doing some things to verify that the folks that are giving their reviews are actually legitimate. So that's important to look for. Some people have a reputation of not showing up.
Yeah.
And then others, don't have that reputation. So.
And, if your neighbors have had things done, talking to...
Oh, absolutely. That's a great resource. Friends and family.
Referral network is always great. Strong.
Yeah, I'm going to have my roof redone thanks to the hail, and it turns out that my former wife, who has had a house a few blocks over, had her roof redone earlier, and so I called her and I said, "Hey, who'd you have?" And she said, "Well, she told me, and it's a local firm for one thing, and also." She has American Family Insurance, and so do I. And she said they work regularly with American Family on these kinds of projects. And she was really happy with the job they did. So
yep.
All I needed, absolutely. To be honest.
Yep.
Ready
yep.
to go.
And ready to go. Oh, man. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to get to Elizabeth from Baraboo in just a minute. But a quick reminder here, we've got Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison. Tony Trapp, owner of Tony Trapp Remodeling and Repair. Past president of NARI of Madison, by the way, our guest as well. And you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tony Trapp of Tony Trapp Remodeling and Repair is our guest today as we talk home remodeling and repair. We've zeroed in a little bit on the trades and trade people and how to find someone that will work for you and with you to get a home remodeling project done. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Elizabeth and Baraboo, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I would like to put a roof over my finished deck. I have a gabled roof, which is too shallow to put a shed-type roof on, and I'm wondering what my options are.
We're trying to visualize here.
Yeah, so are you say you have a deck now that doesn't have a roof, correct?
Yeah. That is correct.
Okay, and the concern is that there's no good way to connect to the existing home and integrate with the existing roof? Is that?
Yes, it's a shallow gable, and I'd have to go quite far up to put a shed roof, you know, because it gets really low as you finish, you know, I want to go 12 feet out.
Is the shallow, is there a gutter and an eave there at the side where the deck is? Or is the gable facing the deck?
The gable faces the deck.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering about another gable roof, which I know is more expensive, but would they be able to tie that in somehow, a separate gable going in the same direction or opposite direction of the current gable?
Yeah, it's possible that the gable could be extended or that a complementary gabled roof could be built over the deck. One concern that I'll just raise, which is separate from the design of the roof, would be that the deck doesn't likely have footings that are adequate for a structure that will have a roof over it. It's possible, but it's not likely. So I want to prepare you for the likelihood that the deck itself will be rebuilt as part of this process.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or significantly modified to accomplish your goal of a beautifully integrated roof.
Yeah. Yes. Is the deck, is it a brick, you know, brick right to the ground, or is it a wood deck that's raised up from the ground?
Yeah, if you get some architectural design and connect with some contractors, they're going to be able to give you some solid advice about your specific circumstance. And then it doesn't hurt to call Digger's Lot Line to see if there's any buried utilities in the area that might impact those footings or private utilities. But there's lots of ways to do it. If you extend the gable and connect to the existing one, just what condition is your existing roof in, how will those shingles look? How far back do they take it? Or if they step it down, it can look okay sometimes too, as long as it's flashed correctly.
Yeah. So a few things to consider there, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for calling. I was flashing back on the deck I had in my lake home, and I kept getting every animal in the woods that was nearby underneath the, and I never seemed to be able to keep them out. So,
oh yeah, habitat. Sure.
I took it out and it's this nice stone right on the ground.
Sure.
It's harder for all the little creatures to live underneath the patio on the ground. For sure.
Thanks, Elizabeth. John in Park Falls, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate the show as usual. But, hey, my question is, I had some custom windows put in my house last year. And the windows are fantastic, but it turns out that the style was incorrect. So the contractor reordered the windows, and that took from last August until this present February to get the correct ones. The correct sashes arrived. They put in the sashes only to find out that the new sashes didn't fit the original frame.
Oh, no.
So it had to go back again. Well, they finally got it all straight and just recently had all the correct stuff installed, but they put up their siding. And so cedar siding had to replace. Long story short, the other half of the house I want to finish this summer, but now I'm not sure I want to go with these people. So how do I get the same windows but different people?
Sure. A lot of times you can contact the manufacturer and they'll have a list of installers in the area that will be able to help you out. Or the distributor will have relationship with local installers. Depending on the manufacturer, they might have like a preferred installer or a trained installer program. So I would reach out to that direction. I personally encountered this, and it wasn't a contractor issue. It was a supplier issue where we were trying to do a repair for a customer, and the manufacturer sent us the wrong product three times. It was very frustrating. And finally we got it right, but it like your frustration, it happens sometimes. So in this case, it might be the contractor, could be the manufacturer, could be the distributor. There's kind of three places in that process where the ball could have been dropped. But it doesn't hurt to reach out and, you know, see what other options are out there.
Yeah. John, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. That's good advice, I think. Join in at 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. Got a remodeling question, maybe a question relating to a tradesperson or trades work that's been done on your home. We'd love to hear from you. Again, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Michael in Middleton emailed, what do you guys think of garage floor resurfacing? And you see a lot of, I see a lot of ads come up on Facebook and on TV where, you know, it's a crummy looking garage floor. And
sure.
They,
oh, like the different epoxies.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's like a lot of things. The devil's in the details, and the preparation makes the biggest difference. An experienced installer. I've experienced a lot of different things through our career, and there's different levels of everything for essentially paint to folks that are doing a lot of preparation to make sure you have good drainage, because water's going to pool on top now and not get absorbed in the concrete, and they're building up that surface where there's a higher acrylic and different flex. It just kind of depends on your goals and your budget, but it can look really nice and be easier to clean if you're into cleaning your garage.
Right.
Yeah, or maybe you're doing work in your garage.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, you want something nice.
We had a West Side customer. They called it their garage porch, and there was an older retired person. He was so proud that every year he didn't have to pay extra taxes. He would open up his door and put in these screen panels because he had a porch and he'd park outside, and they made it just the most beautiful garage you could ever see.
Yep. And I had somebody else do it, have it done, or a friend, and wasn't totally happy because he got water pooling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, wintertime, too. You're bringing snow in and all this and that. And yeah, it was
and
kind of
different
a mess.
Mats, right. You can park on. And so it's got its pluses and minuses for sure.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. Well, Nathan in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, I'm calling because I've been trying to get new windows on my house, and it's an old 1912 Colonial, and I've got like almost 30 windows, but I've gotten multiple bids to get them replaced because I'm tired of replacing the, you know, the storm windows each season with the screen and the glass.
Oh, sure. Yeah. 30 of them. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And the lowest of like four bids was like close to $90,000.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm just, you know, windows are that expensive, or, you know, should I just learn how to do this myself?
Oh, that's an option.
Well, you'll still pay for it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that is not surprising to hear. And, you know, yeah. I was going to say that it's a six-figure project, particularly when you're looking at an old home like that and doing it well. And you probably got custom sizing for a number of those windows, which will have a little bit of an impact. But windows are just very a good window is very expensive right now.
And then with an older home, you've got, I mean, the big thing is getting it done, installed correctly, and what the old windows look like. I mean,
there's several different ways to put in a quote unquote new window. There's a thing kind of called insert or a pocket window where you're leaving the trim inside and outside intact and just putting inside the window. And then if you have those sash weights, are people dense backing those cavities, or, you know, do you have proper flashing details? So there's some trade-offs, as opposed to like a new construction window where everything gets torn out and you can really get in there and flash and seal it up properly. That costs more money, but you have a better product. So keep that in mind when you're looking at those pricings too.
Yeah. So what's a standard window cost? I mean, what's a standard window?
We will typically say that a window, to tear it out and put in a new one fully trimmed, is going to be between $3,000 and $5,000. Now, he just said his lowest quote is 30 windows for $90,000. That's $3,000 a window.
Yep.
And then I would have expected it to be a little more than that.
If they're doing new construction, like Jed said, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if it's a older home, you want to be concerned about lead-based paints, so that they're a lead-safe contractor and they're not like making a big mess.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this brings to mind, in my mind, these do-it-yourself videos.
Oh.
Now, if he goes to one of these do-it-yourself videos, is he going to learn enough to do it?
I would recommend maybe starting with one rather than ordering all 30 and making a compounding big mistake. And, you know, if you can search out in-person classes rather than online classes, because those might not even pertain to our area. A lot of manufacturers have some really good installation instructions depending about your base skill set. But if you don't have any tools or skill, I mean, windows can be pretty tricky next to doors if conditions aren't favorable.
Right. I mean, if it's not properly installed, the odds are pretty good that it will not operate smoothly. It's more likely to then jam or break. I mean, there are all sorts of potential complications and costs down the road if that product is not installed well. And that's not to say that a homeowner is incapable of learning those skills and doing it well. It's absolutely possible. But there are, as Tony suggested, finding a really thoughtful video to help with that is important. There's a lot of online information that is just frankly not good information, not reliable. Someone may have thought of some great tricks that seemed really clever to them, and they're able to post them on the internet, and then thousands of people end up replicating this kind of half-baked idea. But I would search out keywords like, certified installation techniques or industry standard or industry recommended installation practices.
And I was saying, kind of to go along with what Tony was saying too, if you, John Freiberger always says, get the installation instructions from the manufacturer.
100%.
Right.
Make two copies. Yeah. You keep one. Give one to the person that's going to do the installation and say, and John always said, they'll probably have never seen this before. Yeah. But it reminds me that I'm betting that the better window companies would have even videos. Or not.
They might.
Some of them have gone that way. Yeah. Some of them even have QR codes on the product now. You can scan it with your phone. It'll pop up a video for questions or the installation sheets. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
There is a lot of good information out there. It's just that if you don't know what good information looks like, then you can certainly go down a few rabbit holes there.
Got an email from Watertown. Person has a 3-foot section of decorative trim on the fascia of her Victorian home, and it needs to be replaced. So this is not a big job. Who do you call for a job like that? You guys probably too small for a company like either of yours, but
sometimes we do it as filler work, so it doesn't hurt to call a contractor where, hey, maybe you have some skilled carpenters are waiting for like the drywallers to finish up and they can make some millwork out in the shop or something. But it can be challenged to find that, especially if it's high up and the access is hard and getting equipment out there, and that's where it can be tricky. Sometimes there's some painters that have relationships with carpenters that can do some things. And if you can group it with another project, that's always a smart choice. Any ideas, other ideas, Chad?
Those were all solid. I'm not sure what else to recommend.
Yeah. About 5 years ago, I had my house repainted, and there was a problem with a couple of shingles up on the roof, and it's a three-story house. And the painter said, you know, I've got some shingles at home that look pretty close to the ones you've got there. I could put those in for you just while I'm doing the painting up on the gables. And I said, go right ahead. And sure. You know, because he was up there already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did it. And it was 5 years ago, and now I've got to have them replaced because of hail. But it worked for 5 years and yep. Didn't cost me basically much of anything.
Sure.
Some of the smaller jobs, I mean, most of it's, we could have more more cost and access than actually doing the work, just showing up and getting the person up to be close enough to do what they need to do.
And sometimes there are places like, I'll give an example, Ace Hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Ace Hardware in Madison, or some of the Ace Hardwares, will have people who will do kind of small jobs. And I don't know, I'm assuming Ace is going to hire somebody, or going to have people doing it who know what they're doing for a job like that, perhaps.
Yeah, they might have a board where contractors can put their card up there, and then sometimes the folks behind the counter will make recommendations. So that's a good
Ace or anybody else for that matter.
Just same like Chad said before, reaching out to like the Better Business Bureau, mm-hmm. NARI, your local NARI chapter that's close by, neighbor referrals, your other trades, like if you go to a lumber yard or a hardware store. Those are all good places to go.
Nancy in Appleton emailed. She says the tilt and turn windows are very popular in many European countries, but she doesn't see them that much in Wisconsin. What's your opinion of this style window for our Midwest weather?
If you put them in, Chad.
So we've only done a few tilt-turn windows over the years. Marvin used to make a tilt-turn window. I'm pretty sure they've discontinued it, but they did for quite some time. And for any listeners that don't know what it is, it's essentially a window that will open like a door if you turn the handle one direction. And if you turn it the other direction, it will lean out like
tilt out like
an awning window.
There are some really high performing tilt turn windows. I think what we ran into was more of getting local product representation and warranty issues if we're getting essentially an imported window, and if there was a problem or a misorder, how does that get resolved in a timely fashion where you get support on the back end? So that might be the right solution for you. It's a different style, I think, regionally than like a normal double hung or casement, but they offer some unique options that could be right for your particular needs.
Probably going to cost you a couple bucks more.
Yeah, a little bit more than Chad's original window install pricing there. That'd be a premium product for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Dick in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Dick. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. So my situation is here. We've got a house that's about 20 years old. The windows that were put in were weather shield windows. They're a double pane gas filled window. The windows are generally in good shape, except some of the lift springs are starting to fail in the windows and that. My wife wants to replace all of the windows in the house. And do you have another solution for me? because that's darn expensive when you start talking about the number of windows that we have. The windows appear to be in good shape. They're still sealing. But, the lift springs have failed in several of them.
Are these the
Evidently, the parts are no longer available because WeatherShield was bought out by somebody who's not supporting that particular line.
Hmm. Are these clad on the exterior WeatherShield, aluminum cladding, or are they wood?
They're aluminum cladding.
Okay. So I would say if you open them up and inspect very carefully on the bottom, sometimes the cladding fails between the glass and the aluminum, and water gets in there, and they look fine on the inside, but then they start to rot from the inside out. And some folks don't notice it till the bottom's rotted out and the glass drops down a half an inch, and they're pretty excited. And then you're in the market for a new window. Mm-hmm. If that seal is still good and you want to repair them, there are some specialty contractors out there that will try to get some other manufactured or new old stock for parts. We were dabbling in this many years ago. In our area, some of the glass installers will do this window repair. There's a company on the east side that does a lot of, they have some parts in stock. They buy out new old stock, but there might be some in your area as well. And there's a couple online distributors that will get you parts, but sourcing the right part can be a little bit of an adventure and take a couple times. So you can repair them, but if the sash itself is failing or the frame is rotting, I wouldn't invest the money.
Right.
And they, it was Martin Glass, or were you thinking?
Yep. And there's even a newer company in Madison that was rebuilding the sashes. They had some unique process where they would save the aluminum and rebuild it. I think it was a franchise, and I looked at it many years ago. So there are some specialty companies out there. You just got to poke around, see how busy are there, and if you feel like they're a good fit for you.
Yeah. Dick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, our guest, and Tony Trapp, owner of Tony Trapp Remodeling and Repairs. Great to have them with us. Questions for them, give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk home repair and maintenance with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Tony Trapp of Tony Trapp Remodeling and Repairs. Great to have them both with us. Kathleen emailed, her home's electrical box is contained in a basement room that is finished with drywall. There's a door to access the box, but she's been told that running a new line to the box for an electric stove in the kitchen, she has gas now, or an electric car charger in the garage would not be possible because the room is finished and the box is not accessible. I can't imagine why you wouldn't make that.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, what's going to have to happen, some of the drywall or whatever material was used to finish will have to be removed. I mean, and it could just be some access holes if it's drywall. But it depends on the material and how the house is framed, which will determine how difficult it is to fish those wires over to the box. But it's not uncommon to have to open things up. It's just a little bit more disruptive. There will be some demolition cost and then some restoration repair cost involved that are beyond the wiring cost.
Yeah, I mean, most people don't want to look at a big surface-mounted conduit in their highly finished basement.
Right, well, which is the other option.
Can't you put a nice photo or something or painting over it that you can hinge?
Well, over the box, yes.
Yeah, over the box.
On the ceiling, there would be a story line, like a whole flip book of little pictures across your ceiling to cover up all the holes there. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, but you could do it.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yep.
Jay in Menominee has something for us. Jay, hi.
Yes, hi. We've got an old log home with a dense-packed roof. It's a vaulted ceiling, and it's worked great, except for the last couple summers we've been getting some condensation in the roof dripping down into the house. So last fall we had a contractor recommend that we should put a ridge vent in that was get the hot air out of the roof and solve our problem. It did. It stopped the water, but now we noticed we were losing a lot of heat in the wintertime and getting some ice dams. And so we're trading one problem for another and wonder if you had a recommendation or a thought.
I'm curious if you had rodents in your little animals in your dense pack insulation and that changed. That was a change. Because if you lived there many years and no problem and something changed, then there's either like a heating and cooling system change and you're injecting more humidity, the building shifted, the insulation got disrupted somehow, and little critters can go in there and make holes and create problems. And then, you know, exploring it further, maybe through like a home performance and energy evaluation, like a blower door test might be warranted with your unique home.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Because you'll pick that up right away.
Yeah, if they put the house
like
in
an X-ray,
negative air pressure with the thermal camera, those two things together, not just the thermal camera, you can see if, hey, do I need to redense pack this roof? Will this, or is something else going on? And they can give you some advice about any other ideas, Chad? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, when the time comes to put on a new roof, I mean, you might consider creating an actual ventilated roof space above the dense packed area. That's not necessary at this point. I think figuring out what may have changed is going to help explain the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, this time of year, I'm looking at all little critters out there trying to make homes to have little babies, and they do things very quickly that you don't see in places you don't want it, and that might have happened over...
Sounds like you've had some experience with other homes.
Oh, my goodness. Animals, gravity, and water keep me employed. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there you go. So a blower door test, and you can... It's about $500 probably.
It would be worthwhile to do, and just check out the home, and they can do a combustion safety test if you have a naturally vented water heater. There's other benefits there, too.
Yeah. Some insulation contractors will provide the thermal imaging and do some of that as part of a due diligence. You might be able to
get some of that information for
less than the full-on HP evaluation.
Jay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Tom and Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Thank you. And congratulations, Larry, on your 100 years of service. I just wanted to let you know that if you need a small job done, often your home insurance agent will be able to direct you to a very good person, because they don't like to insure things that are rickety.
Yeah.
Seems like sound advice.
That sounds
like a great
like...
thing we didn't think of before. The collective power of all your listeners, Larry. There's smart people.
Yeah, well, that's part of the joy of doing this show.
Absolutely.
Is having people call. And that is an excellent idea.
It really is.
Get a hold of your insurance agent.
Yep.
Yeah. I've had some problems. I actually called the insurance company, my agent, and he put me on to exactly the person I needed to get, or the company I needed to get the job done.
Awesome.
And I had one other local handyman who advertised. His advertisement was something like, no job too small, some jobs too big.
Yeah.
And he put a railing in from my stairs down to the basement and did a fine job.
Awesome.
That was a few years ago. Hope he's still in business, and I was pleased with him. Tom, there you go. Thank you so much. Heather emailed. She wants to make the point that sewing is a skilled trade. What say you? She's a business owner and often needs trained seamstresses.
Oh, there you go.
There is so much crossover between sewing and carpentry. I mean, doing layout and, yes. Yep. Like, well, a lot of the quilters we work for, I'm like, do you want to become a carpenter? We'll get you in a van. We'll get you some training.
Oh, man. Kay from Middleton emailed. She says, as a result of the recent hailstorm, she needs to have her roof and one side of vinyl siding replaced, have a contract not yet signed that gives details about the replacement down to the number of staples, but only says something like, as specified by homeowner for the siding. We told him the brand and the color for the siding, but that's it. Should we sign such a contract?
I would get them to specify the manufacturer in the contract. I believe that's required by our state ACP 110, or what's the code there, Chad?
Yeah.
We have to call it the specific product, and then they can follow the manufacturer installation instructions for that product.
Correct. And so it might just be a little bit of laziness on the part of the contractor, because if you did provide that information and they just simply said what they said, then you just want to confirm that in writing. And the other thing I will mention is that it is often very difficult to match old vinyl siding, because vinyl siding is manufactured by color. The color goes mm-hmm. all the way through the product. Those colors can fade. Even if you have an exact match and you put it up 10 years later, it's probably going to look different. So that's just a part of, that's one of the downsides to vinyl.
Yeah, and there again, if you know the name of the company, you can go online and get their installation instructions.
Yes.
Make two copies, give one to the person, and say, are you willing to follow these instructions for siding?
Exactly.
Yeah, just if you can push to get more, the more you can do in the beginning, the less likely you'll have issues later.
Yeah, that's good advice there. Bill in Green Bay emailed, and Elwood, he said, I did a great job in Green Bay the other night, which was a lot of fun, and thanks to the gang that showed up at the Widener Center in Green Bay. We had a wonderful time. But he also has a question about a window that's spotty and moldy looking. What would be causing that? Well, it'd be moisture, I suppose.
Typically, yeah. A lot of times we see that most commonly in the primary bedroom or bathroom. And usually we're having a conversation about blinds and humidity. So there's so many different things. We want to look at the humidity in the house, and is that caused by the occupants? Is that caused by insulation, like a cellular shade? Or is it like a whole house humidifier that needs to be turned down? Or does the window itself have some leaky seals that's getting colder and maybe that needs to be repaired or replaced? Those are our common things. What am I forgetting here, Chad?
Well, I'll just add that as by way of explanation, that when you have a blind or a shade over a window, you're actually allowing that window to get colder because you are insulating it from the conditioned room that you're occupying. And then So what happens is the glass is getting colder, so the moist air that does escape into that space is going to condense more easily. So it's a little bit of a, unintended consequence of having the blind provide you insulation, but then making the window more susceptible to those sorts of negative conditions.
And you can do a little science. Get a laser thermal thermometer. You can shoot the temperature. You can get an inside hygrometer. Bust out your psychrometric chart, and you can have science fun and find out the dew point. So
yes.
You're just trying to, drop that humidity below the dew point and just do a little science in the bathroom.
And sometimes the solution to this is when you have a blind that will open from the top and bottom, is you want to leave about an inch of gap at the top and bottom so that air can move between that blind and the window and help reduce the mold problem that you're having. You won't have as warm of a room, but you won't have a rotting window.
Yeah. Or you spend more money and get a tri-pane glass window and reduce your condensation potential too. So there's very inexpensive options, like just raising your blinds a little bit to full window replacement.
Right.
I kind of like the cheaper version myself.
Most people do, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Chad Spade and Tony Trapp, our guests today. And Tony, I thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it very much. I know you've got some things to do down the road, but John Gishnock will be joining us after the top of the hour, I believe. And Tony, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
So much. Thank you so much. And congratulations.
Thank you. Tony Trapp, of Tony Trapp Remodeling and Repair, our guest today. And he'll be back probably when Lee Rayburn's hosting the next time. In the meantime, stay with us because Chad's going to stick around and we'll be joined by John Gishnock, owner of Form Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in here on WPR News. You know, Larry Mueller here, by the way, and I'm talking with Jeff Robbins, our producer for today, and he was telling me about scrolling online and coming across a video where a YouTuber claimed to show how to transform your entire backyard in 6 minutes and 33 seconds. Now, this stretches the, there's some credibility issues there, I think, as we talk home improvement and other issues today with our guest, of course, Chad Spate with us, owner of Chad's Design Build, who's been with us for the last hour. But joining us now and back after a while, it's been a while, John Gishnock. John's a landscape architect and owner of Form Ecology. It's a landscape design, build and care firm. And, of course, both Chad and John can take your general home improvement or landscaping questions as we move along today. And again, you can join in the number 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. John Gishnock, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. So happy to be here. Happy to be with Chad. It's a great moment. Love your show. Love all that you do. So thank you for allowing me to be a contributor.
Let's talk about, just to start with, let's talk about Form Ecology. It's been a while since you've been on. Tell us a little about the work you're doing.
You bet. And like we were talking a little bit earlier, a minute ago, about the prairie plant movement, Form Ecology has been around for just about 30 years ago. Chad actually was one of our friends that long ago. But we've always stuck to our guns and striven for more sustainable solutions for landscapes. So our tag is Beauty Today, Green Tomorrow. And that involves a variety of different things. But for homeowners, we want to create a beautiful landscape, but one that isn't as needy as some of, you know, the more traditional landscapes.
So you're using more prairie plants?
Absolutely. Rain gardens, prairie plants, more drought-tolerant lawn grasses, keeping water out of the basement by using our landscape, more local stone instead of the prefabricated stuff. So we're really celebrating Madison and southern Wisconsin's sort of regional identity, right? Same plant, same stone, and we put a house inside our landscape.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about challenges finding skilled tradespeople. You have some in-demand. I mean, what are the most in-demand jobs in the landscaping industry right now?
Well, that's a great question. I think coming off of 10 inches of rain in April, we have been getting a lot of calls about wet basement and drainage issues. So that's a feature of the landscape that sort of goes with the weather and Mother Nature. So we've had a lot of weather and water in the basements, and so calls to deal with drainage have increased a great deal. So that's a big call. A lot of folks want to use their outdoors like they use their indoors. You know, we want to stay home, we want to entertain, and we want entertainment spaces in our backyard. So meditative spaces. So it's not all about passive recreation, but meditative spaces to relax and loosen up our minds a little bit. So and pollinator plants, you know, people, the term pollinator plants works a little better than a native plant in some ways. You know, it's so it inspires good insects and butterflies into our yard, the idea of pollinator plants. So I think people want to help and do their part, and that's an easy way they can do it.
What's a landscaping project that that people probably think they can handle, but probably shouldn't?
That's a great question. I would recommend, and I always do, and I can do this very honestly, is say a hardscape project, a project that involves a patio, walkway, or retaining wall. It's laborious. It's heavy. It needs to be dug down. Compaction is critical, and it is not a weekend warrior job. We warranty our hardscape projects for 5 years. So, you know, there's a lot of places a homeowner can be: mulching, planting, weeding, directing us. But I wouldn't have them start that kind of project. I want to build a hardscape feature for them that will last multiple decades. And the best way to do that is save your money, have a pro help you there, and then let them do a lot more of the sort of softscaping and things they would enjoy.
Yeah, for sure.
It
makes good sense. And Chad, I imagine you guys have worked together.
We have some of the most beautiful landscapes that surround our some of our additions and renovations were done by Formicology. So thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I tell you what, we've got callers online. Some relate to, well, ones we were just talking about rain, and Jim and Madison may have a question relating to humidity, I believe, which means water.
Yes.
Let's go there. Jim, hi.
Hello, Larry and Chad. Hi. Question about humidity in a heated garage space. Hmm. My the home we just purchased has a attached kind of shop / garage area with what I believe are called scissor trusses. So it's a finished ceiling. Mm-hmm. And there's a big old like whole house fan in it with ventilation. But on top of the roof, there's no direct exhaust. So, I mean, is this a situation where I might run into rot in the wintertime with, you know, heated garage, melting snow, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. So, I think what I heard you say was that the whole house fan is venting from the semi-finished garage up into that scissor truss attic space.
That's correct.
And then there's no good ventilation out of that roof. Yeah, so
nope,
that is
gable vents and soffits.
Okay. Yeah, so that is definitely risky because the heated garage will have much more capacity. The air in the garage will have much more moisture capacity. I'm not sure that your garage will have conditions in it that make that air particularly humid. But if it is humid, then you will have potential problems. And for our listeners, that's going to be that hot air will be vented directly up into a cold cavity that is going to be a place where that moist air is likely to condense on the underside of the roof deck. And then, you know, sometimes what we'll see is that condensed moisture will drip down on the drywall. I remember one attic we went into 25 years ago that literally looked like it was a mushroom farm. There were mushrooms growing everywhere from off the rafters, on the ceiling joists, and it was just a poorly ventilated attic in a very humid, plant-filled home. And I was amazed and a little terrified when I saw that. Went up in the attic, and I mean, literally, mushrooms everywhere.
Oh, my goodness. Me.
So you don't want that.
Yeah. Jim, there you go. Thank you for calling. Doug in Colfax, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I had the privilege of hearing your presentation at the Pablo Center in Eau Claire a few weeks ago. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And congratulations on retirement. You will be missed.
Thank you.
I have a question about one more window question. Mm-hmm. I've got a 100-year-old brick schoolhouse that got converted into apartments about 40 years ago. All vinyl windows that are starting to fail as far as leaking and not being their sliders that aren't latching properly anymore. I'm just wondering about the cost. I've got 9 going in at $2,500 bucks a piece or so. And this building's got 57 windows in it. I did the arithmetic. That's going to be $140,000 if I eventually replace them all. Does that sound reasonable?
Well, I believe your math is correct. And, whether or not it's reasonable, that's a good question. But I can tell you that that's likely what it will cost to do it. Windows are important. They are literally the hole in the wall. So that's where we have the least insulation value. And it's also where we have a lot of gaskets that are going to help reduce, if not eliminate, the drafting that would often occur around an older window. So, you know, it is a good place to invest wisely, because it's going to directly impact your comfort and your heating bill. But it is also just incredibly expensive. And so I don't mean to be dismissive of that. And I would say the strategy that I think will work for most homeowners is to think about doing it in phases. We have worked for decades with homeowners to, finish, replace windows one side of the house at a time. Occasionally, that's a way to spread out that cost. And that might be a strategy that works for you in that old schoolhouse.
Yeah. Good luck, Doug. It sounds right. Mm-hmm. It sounds about right when you're talking the cost.
Right.
Thank you for calling. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. What's on your mind, Pat?
Hi. I'm wondering if you have any ideas on native plants that could outcompete invasive plants. And the one plant I'm thinking of in particular is Snow on the Mountain. I don't know the botanical name, but I pull it and I don't get all of it, and it spreads. And now it's spreading in the back of our yard, going into a tree area, that it makes me really sad to see that.
Yeah, and so there, you're not the first person I've, and often on Garden Talk, this will come up. Snow on the Mountain does not like to be sitting in just one spot. It seems, John, and.
Yeah, absolutely. Bishop's Wheat is another one we're always dealing with, creeping bellflower. My honest opinion, it's hard to find another plant that would outcompete a non-native invasive plant for ground cover. Our approach is to try to get rid of those invasive plants first. Now, there are a couple different techniques, and I know sometimes a whole yard's covered with them, smothering with plastic, solarizing with plastic, smothering with cardboard. If you don't mind a little bit of chemical, sometimes that's an opportunity or an option to use. But I feel like leaving some of those there and planting into them, plants won't overtake them. If we had a native plant that would compete that well, we'd probably be creating another problem in some ways. Yeah. It's hard to outcompete some of the best, most aggressive competitors we have running around our urban landscape. And we spend a little more time getting rid of it. So when you do bring back new plants, you're not still fighting those two. You could start in the back. You could start in the side yard with a smother or solarization project. But the typical plants that are good growers for natives, like goldenrods and asters and things like that, you know, they're beautiful and desirable, but they could spread beyond what you want mm-hmm. them to, too.
Yeah. But the takeaway is you need to kind of get rid of the Snow on the Mountain entirely.
Without a doubt. I really would. I think it's, unless it's bordered or containerized in some way that you can manage it, it always wants to move around.
Yeah.
Yep, for sure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Pat, there you go. Excuse me. A little cough there. Let's turn to Ted in Madison. Ted, hi.
Hello. I was wondering if our clover lawn's a thing in Wisconsin. My wife and my kid are bugging me about it, and they want me to replant my yard with clovers.
Clovers have a lot going for them. They fix nitrogen, for one thing, yes, in the soil. And it, as a matter of fact, I'm thinking back to my talking with our lawn guy that everybody had it. There was a time when every lawn had clover in it. And
sure,
part of the reason was the nitrogen that the clover provided. And then we went through a whole period where nobody wanted anything but Kentucky bluegrass,
right,
in the lawn. And now it's swung back a bit, and more seed mixes are coming with clover in the mix.
Right, right.
John, I mean...
Absolutely. We've been asked over the past 5 years more and more about them. We've advised clients, but we haven't installed a clover lawn yet. What I've heard is people have had some difficulty getting them established, clover lawns. And I think some of the areas they probably want to start out with are a little big, too, and maybe they would work in a smaller yard. I'd love to do more with them and try them out a little bit more. But what I've heard from other people, they were just having some difficulty getting them established in a lawn. From compaction and play on them, we have to look at that. I don't think they're good for, some of them are the micro clovers might be good for dogs and play, but I think, you want to know how you want to use your lawn first before you try switching it.
If you're going to. I think the idea that works the best is to have it as part of, or if you're starting a lawn, having Kentucky bluegrass and clover in the mix, so you're starting right from scratch.
Yes, agreed. And then you're kind of living with a bit of that grass look and the broadleaf plants in it.
Yeah.
And of course, the movement to have more of these early blooming flowers in our lawns is increasing, too. So this is the no-mow May. And just like you said, we used to not want clover or any broadleaf flowers in our lawn. And now we're saying it's okay because it's good for pollinators. So Creeping Charlie, self-heal, clovers, all in bloom, dandelions.
Yeah.
So those are good to keep in a lawn. And so yeah, I think, mixing it into a lawn is probably more appropriate and would do better.
Yeah. Thank you. That might be your approach, Ted. Thank you very much for calling. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann. Ann, are you there? Maybe we want...
Are you saying Ann?
Ann, yeah, Ann. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. I had a question about redoing the roof over because of hail damage. We had our roof done, and it's just the flat. It's not a sculptured shingle. Just under 2 years ago, and we need to have it replaced because of hail damage. When it was done before, they stripped it all. They put new, because our house is 98 years old, they put new sheets, 4x8 sheets of the...
Sure,
right.
I forget what it's called, over the old boards. And so I'm wondering if it would be advisable to strip it again, the shingles off, or can the new layer be put on over the hail-damaged shingles?
Mm. Yeah, that's a great question. So the standard or the it is okay typically to add a second layer of roofing, particularly if you only have that old school single layer three tab shingle. If you had an architectural shingle, it would not really be possible to build up over top of that. And if you were adding an architectural layer, you'd really be probably adding too much material to the roof deck, because part of the problem with too many layers of roofing is simply weight. Houses are not built to have that much weight on the roof, and then once you get a snow load, you've got problems. The good news, though, is that because your roof is so new, they've got two options, and I don't know if you've had some roofers looking at it. I would lean on them for their recommendation based on the condition of things after the hailstorm. But there's certainly nothing wrong typically with going over that single layer, and you do have a new good substrate underneath. So yeah. I think you've got an option.
Yeah, and you could check with your insurance company, too, because I'm sure they're probably shelling out some money, especially if it's only 2 years old.
Right, that's right.
The percentage of the cost to replace is probably going to be much higher than like for my home, which is about 45%.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's practically my, no depreciation there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, due to depreciation. So
right.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Michael wondered about maintaining a protective rain garden. Is there a lot of work to maintaining a rain garden?
No. I'm assuming it's a couple hundred square feet. It's a homeowner's rain garden. No. First thing, you treat it like your standard perennial bed or planting around the house, and if you don't like weeds in the bed, kind of adopt those habits for your rain garden. If you live with weeds in your bed, you can live with a couple of weeds in a rain garden. But essentially the maintenance of a rain garden, and we mulch them when we're done with a couple of inches of mulch. So we treat a rain garden like a planting bed in a lot of ways, a regular perennial garden. It can be remulched every couple of years. You keep an eye on weeds. One unique thing about rain gardens is we have a lot of birds and unique critters visiting it, so it can drop in seeds like reed canary grass or one of our more aggressive goldenrods. So keeping an eye on it, keeping your rain garden weeded is probably the most important thing. You can cut it back in late spring or summer. So there's this new movement, too, of keeping our dead stuff up in our yards longer for critter habitat and insect population. So cutting it back in late spring is probably the other thing. Mulching. And I love to know what the plants are. So the key is in weeding a rain garden is a lot of homeowners won't have seen a lot of these native plants before, and they don't know what they look like. So first rule of thumb is if you don't know what it is, don't pull it until you do. And so letting the plants grow up and flower can help you know when to pull a weed. So a weed could theoretically live in a garden for a little while until it goes to seed and becomes even worse. So until you're sure, wait a minute and pull the weed.
That makes a lot of sense. I have pulled the wrong. There are some weeds that look a lot like some of the native plants, and I have not waited, and I have regretted it. Let's right. let's put it that way. Oh my gosh, John, thanks for that.
You bet.
And I know. I think Chad, you had a question for me.
I did. Well, Larry, so first off, I just want to say I'm so grateful to have been on this show for 20 years.
Yeah, and 20 years.
And we're going to miss you. I'm going to miss you very much. I'm curious over your 59-year career. I imagine there are some people that you did not get the chance to interview on air that perhaps in retirement, you might have the opportunity to reach out to them with your good name and have a conversation or maybe share a meal. I'm wondering if there's any one or a couple of people that come to mind that you might like to still have a nice chat with.
The one person that I was never able to get on was Louise Penny. Louise Penny is a celebrated novelist from Canada. And she wrote the Inspector Gamache series of mysteries, and I've read every single one of them. Huh. And we have tried mightily to get Louise on the show. So if I was wanting to sit down and have a cup of coffee with somebody, it would be with Louise Penny.
That's great. That's great.
Well, Chad, it's been a pleasure working with you, and I'll be listening in when Lee interviews you. I can tell you that. Maybe I'll call in.
All right.
With my own thoughts.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome.
And, well, thank you both very, very much for being with us. John, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
John owns Formicology LLC. It's a Wisconsin-based landscape design, build, and care firm. And Chad Spade, of course, Chad's design, build, been with us 20 years. And I should mention that Chad's Design Build and actually Tony Trapp Remodeling are two Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So we appreciate that as well.
Can I quickly add something, Larry?
Sure.
I believe today is your birthday. And so I wanted to wish you a very, very happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Larry, for sure.
I was born on Mother's Day way back in the 82 years ago.
That's awesome.
Appreciate that very much. Thank you, guys.
A pleasure being here again. Thank you.
We're going to turn our attention to a totally different topic and take a look at scuba diving in Lake Michigan. I've done a little bit of scuba diving, not recently, but never in Lake Michigan. And our next guest has done it for 50 years. So we'll talk to our next guest, Jerry Geyer, in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, you don't need to be in some exotic tropical location to scuba dive. Although my daughter a couple years ago was scuba diving on about 70 feet deep in the Caribbean on a research project relating to coral reefs. But our next guest has come with a lot of experience to share with us. Maybe you've thought about those shipwrecks, those historic shipwrecks that we find on Lake Michigan. You can do that in Lake Michigan and not far out from Milwaukee. And our next guest is going to tell us about it. Now we'll talk scuba diving around Lake Michigan shipwrecks with our next guest, Jerry Geyer. Jerry has led shipwreck charter trips for scuba divers in the Milwaukee area for more than 50 years, boat captain for Lender Dive Charters, and the owner of Jerry's Silo Marina. As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What, have you ever scuba dived? Have you ever gone down deep to explore a shipwreck? Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jerry Geyer with us by phone. Jerry, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
No problem, Larry.
You've been doing this for more than 50 years. You've led scuba diving trips on Lake Michigan. Why do you think people find shipwrecks so fascinating?
Well, it's like stepping back in history. It's what things used to be. And it's always exhilarating diving, whether it's the cold water of Lake Michigan or the warm Caribbean water. There's something about being under the water and being with equipment that provides you life support, air, and surviving that, and then tell the stories afterward.
Yeah, the scuba people told me, well, that's always going to be the cleanest air you're ever going to breathe.
That's correct.
And I found that comforting somehow as I put that that tank on. And you've personally discovered sunken boats. Tell us about some of those discoveries.
Yes, it's been quite a ride, and I'm actually hoping to go out tomorrow and look for some more new shipwrecks. Tomorrow's my 79th birthday, and that's how I'm going to celebrate it.
Oh, well, today's my birthday, and I'm not far off from, I'm a little older than you, but not too much. Hey, do you still dive yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I started in 1964, so it's been a long time, and things have really changed. Equipment's really changed, and it's gotten a lot safer.
I was doing some research, and something like 30 shipwrecks were discovered in Lake Michigan just over the past few years. And you wonder, why haven't we found those before?
Well, some of them were found before, but the people kept it quiet. There's a little mystery and a little bit of selfishness, I guess, on some people's part of not sharing what they find. But technology has just gotten so much better. So if you've got the money and the time, anybody can find shipwrecks.
So when you're talking technology, what kind of newer technology is helping?
It's called side-scanning sonar. It allows you to go up to 5 or 6 knots of boat speed and scan a swath of the bottom approximately 500 feet on each side of your towed fish, your transponder.
Oh, so you can cover a lot of area in a relatively short time compared to what you used to have to do.
Exactly, exactly. The downside is how many hundreds of square miles Lake Michigan alone provides.
Yeah, yeah, there's hundreds of miles. And what do shipwrecks, I mean, do they really reveal things about our history?
Well, many of them have cargo. So you can look at the cargo. Some of it's deteriorated, such as grain, which used to be the major cargo on the Great Lakes, was grain and lumber. But many of them have steel products, household products, all kinds of, from automotive fender caps to whatever, toilet sinks. There's just a whole long list of different cargoes that are sitting there.
With so many of these recent shipwreck discoveries, what effect has that had on your business?
Well, you certainly would think it would have a profound effect. Unfortunately, the youth of today are not exactly into the actual physical sport of scuba diving. They'd rather be looking at the virtual world on their phone or tablet.
Oh, so that has had a very negative effect on the business then.
Absolutely. In fact, the other end of the spectrum is the people that are aging out that are on the last part of their diving career because of health and age. So there's no younger people to replace them.
And I know many dive shops have closed. I mean, how many dive shops and charters were there at their peak, and how many remain?
Milwaukee alone used to have more than a half a dozen dive stores. I had a dive store for 42 years that I just closed last year. So it was the last dive store in the city of Milwaukee.
Wow. And it was just, a business decision.
Yes. Yeah, there was just, well, it was an easy decision because there was no longer any customers.
That's too bad. My, as I was mentioning earlier, my own daughter is 22 years old, and she has really enjoyed diving, but as part of it related to research that she was working on. What are some of the, let's talk about some of your best memories from running a dive shop.
Well, it's the people that come in some cases quite timid, in some cases they can't even swim, and they stick with it. They are now independent divers that can, with a safety buddy, go to the Caribbean, go anywhere in the world. The Caribbean is still alive and well, and in fact, they've picked up the slack of training because it's just as easy to go anywhere in the world and get your training right there at the resort, and then scuba dive.
Yeah, but training still exists. I mean, you can be trained in Milwaukee, can't you?
Absolutely, yeah. There's still two stores in the suburbs that are doing a great job and training new divers, and many of them come out on my charters.
And tell us about what people see when you take them out on a charter.
Well, last Saturday we had six young men, and we went out to the dredge number 6, which is in 75 feet of water, just off of Howard Avenue, I guess, about 3 miles out. And that's an upside-down dredge, which is was a fatal accident when it flipped over. And they basically dive around and look around. We had one man with a spear gun, and he was able to, on the second dive, we typically do two dives. The second dive was on the Prince Wilhelm, and he was able to spear two burbot, a type of freshwater cod.
Oh, all right. Well, here's an aside. You must need a license, or do you need a license to spearfish?
No, not really, because that's considered a rough fish. And if you don't.
Yeah,
but they're an odd fish because not many people know about They're a freshwater cod.
Okay. But you don't want to be spearing a king salmon.
No, oh no. You cannot spear with or without a fishing license. You cannot spear any game fish.
Oh. Man.
And nobody does. I mean,
no.
It's pretty rare for this man to spear fish. I mean, for anybody. He's the only person I've ever had in all my years of chartering that's actually speared fish on a diving charter.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, I was thinking about movies. Oh, we're having a little noise issue here.
That should go away. Those are other phone calls I'm getting. I just reject them.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully we can, block them out while we're talking. Well, how is scuba diving in Lake Michigan different from scuba diving in the tropical waters?
It's an entirely different thing. Your thermal protection, and you probably should have a dry suit. The water is approximately 40 degrees on the bottom. It's in the mid-50s as you come up, but you have to have thermal protection that protects you from that temperature if you're going to stay there more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
In the Caribbean... The Caribbean has gotten so warm, you can scuba dive pretty easily in a swimming suit.
Yeah.
The water's 82, 83 degrees.
Jerry Geyer, our guest today, he has led shipwreck charter trips for scuba divers in the Milwaukee area for 50 years. He's a boat captain for Lender Dive Charters in Milwaukee. It's great to have him with us. Questions for him or maybe an experience to share. Have you done some scuba diving or maybe have questions about what all is involved? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Hope you'll join us tomorrow for Garden Talk. Horticulturist Mark Dwyer is one of our guests, so we'll be talking flowers and landscape with him. And then for the second segment of the show, we'll turn our attention to straw bale gardening and Joel Karsten, who's written the book on it, the man who pioneered the method, will be talking with us about it. That's tomorrow at 11 on Garden Talk. And just a quick mention, a big thanks to the Green Bay folks who were with us for our talk this past Tuesday. And I have one more of these talks scheduled. Well, we'll be doing Bayfield in Bloom, and that's the last Friday in May. And you can sign up for that if you're in that area. And in the Madison area on June 3rd, I will be giving a talk in the evening with Jill Nadeau, and that's June 3rd. I believe it starts at 7 o'clock, and we will be at the Barrymore Theater. And you can sign up, again, go to WPR.org/presents. Tickets are free, but we need to know how many are coming for the swag, if nothing else, because there's some giveaway parts going on with that as well. Right now, we're talking about scuba diving to visit shipwrecks with Charter Captain Jerry Geyer. And again, you can join in. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you email to talk@WPR.org. Anne wonders, which shipwrecks do your tour group seem to enjoy the most?
Is that a question for me, Larry?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Jerry.
Yeah, by far the Prince Wilhelm, which sunk in 1954 upon trying to leave Milwaukee with a cargo of products, is probably the most popular shipwreck in all of Lake Michigan.
And why?
It's only 3 miles straight east of Milwaukee's main harbor entrance. It's in 75 feet of water. It's perfectly intact. It's 253 feet long. It's just the ideal conditions for a safe 20 to 40 minute dive.
Oh, that sounds really cool. How, and it's intact.
Yeah, it ran. It was a crazy story, but it ran into a cable which was pulling a barge, and the barge cut a gash just like the Titanic on the starboard side below the waterline. It slowly filled with water. The Coast Guard went out and got the crew off, and it sunk. People could see it sinking from shore.
Oh, man. I'm wondering why it's still intact after all these years. I mean, you'd think there'd be deterioration, and obviously there has been deterioration.
There's one major crack, but other than that, it's a steel ship, so it's perfectly intact.
Oh, it's a steel ship. Oh.
Yes.
So for the wood ones, the older ones, there's got to be plenty of deterioration going on there.
Yeah, the zebra mussels and quagga mussels have definitely added to that. But if they're deep enough, if they're over 100 foot of water, they're still pretty much intact.
That is very, very cool. What's the oldest one that you've dived on?
Probably the one right here on Oklahoma Beach. And I'm trying to think of the name. It'll come to me in a second here. 1856, that it went aground with tons of cargo, household goods. You could probably still go there and find brass stick pins and different pieces. The Sevastopol, it was called.
Oh, the Sevastopol. I've heard that name.
Yep, right at Oklahoma Beach in about 12 foot of water.
What kind of equipment do you provide the equipment for the divers?
No, we have rental scuba tanks, but most divers have their own suits and other regulators and the buoyancy control jackets. We have some stuff we rent out, but for the most part, a person that's going to be in the sport does purchase their own set and maintain it, so they are very familiar with it.
Bill in Oregon emailed, he has a 6-millimeter full-body wetsuit that he uses for freshwater diving, and he wants to know, how much time would that buy him at, say, 40 to 60 feet in Lake Michigan?
A 20 to 40-minute dive. The man with the spear gun I mentioned earlier was wearing a wetsuit, so you can, even this time of the year, wear wetsuits. And here's an interesting fact. All the wrecks I take people to, at some point in my career, I've dove in on them with a swimming suit. There is times in the summer where the thermocline gets depressed so that no matter what depth you're at, even 100, over 100 feet, you're still in 65-degree water.
Oh, well, that's pretty nice, actually.
So,
Jack in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Larry. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah, it just so happened to be my birthday about a week ago, but all that aside, I had both a story to share and a question for your guests.
Okay.
I've always wanted to go diving for shipwrecks. Unfortunately, I've not had the opportunity just yet, but I just think back to when my uncle took our family to go. We had a scuba diving lesson at the Sun Prairie High Pool around Mother's Day weekend a couple weeks ago. And I just remember how cool it was, you know, getting to, you know, wear a scuba mask and tank and learn the different hand signals. And it was just really cool learning how to do that. But I did want to ask your guests, like, how one gets involved with diving for shipwrecks and, you know, get to, you know, see what has become of old ships after they sink and can only be accessed from below the waves for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. So, and what kind of experience, I guess, too, Jack, I think it was getting at as well. What kind of?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes, you should have experience in inland lakes. There are some days where Lake Michigan is calm enough and the shipwreck is shallow enough that we take relatively new people. But for the most part, you should have gone through at least to the advanced diver level in an inland lake. And then you'd work up to diving in Lake Michigan. But having the good thick wetsuit and or a dry suit is another good help.
And you're probably, I imagine the weather and lake conditions really do affect your trips.
Absolutely. It's I cancel many charters for the weather and be safe. I've seen enough seasick people in my lifetime. I don't need to see one more.
What sort of permit or permission do you need before visiting these shipwrecks? I mean, the fact that you're probably permitted in some way or another or not?
No, believe it or not, scuba diving is beyond all state laws. There's one law that we have to have a red and white flag, and then if you're out in Lake Michigan with potential international ships, you have to also fly the Alpha flag. Other than that, no, there is no state laws that have any involvement with scuba diving.
And there's a law that I think prevents the theft of.
Oh yes, I should admit. Yes.
Talk about that you're not supposed to be stealing things from shipwrecks.
Right, the Preservation Act, and I forget what year that went into play. And it's true that back, you know, over 40 years ago, people did remove things. But to be honest with you, there's really nothing left to remove. Mother Nature deteriorates things to the point where. Someday there'll be nothing there.
Yeah. And somebody else is wondering, how do people book a charter trip with you?
Oh, well, if I can put in a little plug here, my new website is jerrysmke.com, jerrysmke.com. And there's an event calendar on there. You'll see we go out Wednesday nights for what we call open charter. Anybody can book. And Thursday nights, and then the weekends we usually have groups.
Oh, okay. And so a group would, I suppose it depends on how many you're taking out, what the cost
is. Yeah, six people is basically the maximum size group, and we go with four once in a while.
Yeah, and what do you hope your guests take away from?
Oh, it's an real appreciation for what they see, and diving, don't start it. And it's just hard to describe, to be very honest with you. After all these years, it's still hard to describe to people until you've experienced it, what it's like to go under the water and breathe and come back up and tell people what you've seen.
Yeah, I think you're ready. You're going to keep going this till you can't do it anymore?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, I hope. Well, I hope to find at least one or two more brand new shipwrecks and get to dive on them too.
And give that website again.
It's Jerry's MKE, JerrysMKE.com.
Well, I tell you what, Jerry, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. And I hope you get another long years ahead yet doing this. It sounds like you've had a lot of fun over the years.
Oh yeah, lots of experience. I've met a lot of people, and it's been very interesting.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. You have a good day, and again, happy birthday to you.
Thanks, Jerry. Jerry Geyer has led shipwreck chatter trips for scuba divers in Milwaukee for about 50 years. And he's boat captain for Lender Dive Charters in Milwaukee. Great to have him with us. And great to have you joining in with us, too. We appreciate you being here on the show with us today and listening in. Our team, of course, thanks you as well. They work pretty hard to make sure we have a deep dive, shall we say, in all of our topics. Producers Clara Neipert and Joel Batnaud. Technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay tuned. Lots more in store here on WPR News.